So I guess hopefully that will pick me up. So yes, just for the recording, I'm Rachel Redfern, one of the senior attorney advisors here, and I'm doing the meeting today. And I know Professor Butler has to head out around 2:45.
Yes.
And then Chanel probably is not going to be able to make it. She's in a committee hearing. And then Professor Raymond is on speaker. And then everyone else is here. And so, and we're recording. And so on Richard's behalf, I just wanted to mention a few reminders that the first draft of report number 3 and report number 4 was sent out on Monday, March 13th. And the deadline for comments on the first drafts of those two reports, number 3 and number 4, is April 24th. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of April, after that April 24th deadline for comments, there are going to be two new reports concerning draft general provisions, which will be submitted for advisory group review concerning attempts and classification of offenses. It's possible there may be an additional report on general enhancements that may go out end of April or perhaps early May, but nothing until after the deadline for comments on reports, first draft of reports 3 and 4. And finally,
do we know when the deadlines are for those, though? The ones that are coming out at the end of April?
No, but they have to be at least, I believe, a month. So it wouldn't be. I know, and just also, Dave's going to be gone for around that time. And so the previously scheduled May 3rd meeting has been moved to Wednesday, May 17th, mm-hmm. 2 to 4. Okay? So with the scheduling out of the way, I would just like to move to the voting item, discussion and voting item, the enactment plus materials. Recall it's the report and then the appendices also, which include that giant, giant bill. They were sent out, I believe, April 3rd. And so, and just to refresh everyone's recollection, I will attempt to pull them up here. So yeah, the voting draft of the report, and then the giant bill, and then the other appendices. And so with this today as a voting item, if it were approved, the plan would be to send it to the council and the mayor by the end of April. Obviously, an electronic copy would go to the advisory group as well. Richard wanted to note that independent of this vote, any of the voting members can send in a written statement if they want appended, so it wouldn't be incorporated into the changes of the actual documents, but I guess like a final statement as to the hopefully approved version. And that would be within 3 weeks by April 26th, and all this will go in, again, minutes and an email. So again, there'll be a final chance to say any final thoughts on the enactment plus items. I was anticipating it being essentially a roll call vote. Per the statute of the five voting members, three is necessary. And so I was just going to go down the line in alphabetical order, which I hopefully have come up with correctly. But are there any questions?
Some discussion about alphabetization.
There was. Yeah. Butler, Raymond got a little tricky. But are there any questions?
Really? Because we can go over that.
Yeah, we figured it out. Don't worry. We got to the bottom of
yes,
it.
Yes, we caught that. But that was going to be the game plan, and I just wondered if anybody had any questions about doing that before we vote.
Sorry, I was continuing to talk.
Are there any questions on enactment plus stuff before we vote? All right, I guess I will. And Don, are you hearing all this?
I am.
Excellent. Okay, well then I guess I will just go down the line and ask again. It would just be obviously the red lines would be accepted, so it wouldn't go out redlined. The changes that were noted would be made. It would be a non-redlined version of the report and the draft bill and the remaining appendices. And so a vote yes would be please send those on, and a vote no would be, I guess, no, don't send them on. So I will go with Professor Brayman.
Yes.
Yes. Professor Butler?
Yes. I vote yes, yeah.
Yes. Ms. Cooper from USAO?
Yes.
Ms. Hankins from PDS?
Yes.
And Mr. Rosenthal from OAG?
Yes.
Oh wow. So that's 5 votes, yes. Very, very good.
If one of us was going to object, you would have probably heard that earlier.
That's the beauty of those other meetings.
You know? Excellent. So that will be, again, so April 26th, final written statement to accompany the final versions. And the meeting, the minutes will reflect all this, as will, I'm sure, the email. And so...
So April 26th is the yes. date that this would be transmitted.
He didn't give a date for that. End of April, but before that, by April 26th, if you wanted to say a final statement about, you know...
Oh, that would accompany this.
Yeah,
not,
so like...
Not
exactly. So by
us,
end of April, get all this to the council, but if there was some last-minute thing that your agency wanted to raise... feel free to incorporate that into a statement that would just kind of go along with it. And yes, excellent. And I think what would be remaining in terms of discussion items would be first, the first draft of report number 3, which was the recommendations for chapter 2, a mistake, deliberate ignorance and intoxication. You're going to take that up first, and then it would be first draft of report number 4, recommendations for some preliminary provisions. And so there wasn't really anything that we wanted to affirmatively raise, but we would be happy to take questions. And again, always are happy to meet with anybody who has questions. But in terms of the first report, first draft of report number 3, and I guess I can pull up.
Sorry, Rachel, just the, comments for this again, they're due April 26th, you said?
24th.
For the first,
26th.
For the enactment plus, any final statements would be on April 26th. The formal written advisory comments on first draft of reports number 3 and number 4 would be April 24th.
So presumably that we would discuss those comments that May 17th meeting. Yeah.
I would assume so.
Okay.
Yeah. But if there are any questions now, Michael will be happy to field them.
It looks like there's a willful blindness provision in,
yeah.
I guess that's part C.
Yeah.
And is that just trying to reflect existing law or what?
So there's not much DCCA case law. There's really only like one on-point DCCA case on willful blindness, and it's just kind of ambiguous. So this was a codification, basically, of what might be deemed the common law approach. There's a model penal code approach to the issue, which is a little bit different. The nationwide legal trends part of the report goes through this pretty extensively, explaining some of the issues with the MPC approach, which has only been adopted, I think, by like a small handful of legislatures. So this is the approach, I believe, that courts tend to apply more often, and it's sort of it's a codification of it.
Right, but it's not a codification of existing DC law.
Right, so existing DC law hasn't really specified the contours of willful blindness. It's just generally recognized that willful blindness doctrine exists.
Right, I mean, it exists, but not in every jurisdiction. In general, I'm not a fan of willful blindness just because it's a fiction, right? So it applies to when knowledge is the standard, and says, well, okay, you can still be guilty even if you didn't know, if
right.
you were reckless about it. And, you know, I think knowledge is a more culpable mental state than recklessness, so
yeah.
I'm just not a fan of the doctrine.
That's a perfectly reasonable point. I know one thing, that there's a requirement that the reason the person failed to avoid confirming or failed to investigate was for the purpose of avoiding criminal liability. So that really narrows its scope. And again, you know, reasonable minds can differ whether someone who specifically knows, let's say, for example, that the contraband is drugs, versus someone who's merely aware of a risk but also avoids investigating for the sole purpose of preserving criminal liability, whether those two people are equally culpable. But at that, in any event, it's a much narrower version of the doctrine than is, let's say, the MPC applies.
So perhaps along those same lines, I'll tell you, and I was just Katya and I have not had a chance to talk because she's been in trial. But I sort of underline the high probability thing.
Which page are you?
Page 22. The sort of high probability that. What am I reading here? That the fact that we're like perhaps becoming willfully blind to a high probability that is a fact.
Right.
And you rejected that. One of the things I thought as I was reading it is, perhaps I live with that because of this, the purpose of avoiding criminal liability, and I want to know if V means V, or if it can be A.
Sorry,
With the sole or primary purpose being avoiding criminal liability, or one of the things that crosses my mind when I'm like, I bet that's not the case, but God, if it was. That could, you know, a person could get in trouble for that. Like, if one of the things that goes through my mind
sure.
is criminal liability, but there's not a high probability that as far as I'm concerned, that there is something that would make this criminal, am I still guilty? Did you use the purpose on purpose, or could it
right,
be
no,
a purpose?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. It's ambiguous. And as I was drafting, working on it, there was... I did not have a clear distinction in mind, and you know, in terms of let's say,
it does seem to be like a sliding scale, right? Like I could maybe live without the high probability part of the scale if really it was the primary or the sole purpose
right.
that I didn't investigate
first. Yeah. So right, that's an interesting point. So there's two things there. One, I would just point out in terms of one of the problems with high probability is we already have knowledge being practically certain. And we already have recklessness being a substantial risk. And so high probability would add presumably yet a third gradation on the level of differentiating between risk awareness. Now, there's not much, but there's some recent empirical research which shows that jurors seem to have a very hard time differentiating between a substantial risk and a practically certain risk. In various fact patterns they were given, it's one or two studies that have been done. It's not by no means conclusive, but there is it. That being said, you know, there's a concern that even adding a third gradation on that scale is something that's manageable. That aside, yeah, I think you make a very valid point in terms of that. Maybe you could give two different fact patterns highlighting the distinction between sort of a V purpose and A purpose. So
a classic example of willful blindness is if it's a crime to serve alcohol to an underage person.
Right.
And the person who's charged, let's say that the person who served appears to be underage, and the person who's doing the serving doesn't ask for ID.
Right.
So in Laura's example, the issue would be, well, what if she didn't ask for ID because she was busy, and also maybe because she thought that the person looked under 18 and she didn't want to deal with that.
Yeah, so busyness or would not fall under this this definition, right? So
but A purpose is this. Actually, I was going to give a different example, right? When we talked about this before, it was the like, you know, the person who says, carry my luggage back across the border. So, you know,
right, that's
like
exactly
that.
Right, yeah.
And I don't say, you know, elderly Aunt Susie, are you smuggling drugs? Because, like, okay, it's possible, but it's unlikely But it crosses my mind, but I'm rushing, the gate's closing, I gotta get through the TSA line, there's a million reasons that I don't follow up
right.
with seriously what's in the suitcase.
Yeah.
And it's elderly Aunt Susie.
Right.
So, it's not a high probability.
Right.
But she is try not to look in the bag and here and,
Yeah.
Whatever. Mafia name on the other side will be needing you to take this or whatever that I like there's some clue but I'm like oh for God's sake it's not right
so right.
It's low probability but it crosses my mind this would be crazy if it was drugs
right so
that's what I mean about the sliding scale
right but in that hypothetical the person does not have the purpose to avoid criminal liability
it is I'm not going to get into it is a purpose it is I Oh, because crossing my mind is not enough, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so there's two things there. One, it's just worth pointing out that there's the gross deviation standard attached to recklessness is quite robust and deals with a lot of the situations to begin with. In this situation, it's not even clear to me that the person is reckless because it's not just awareness of a substantial risk. It's also the person's conduct must constitute a gross deviation from community norms. So in that particular fact pattern, it's not even clear that the government could establish recklessness. That aside, the government's burden here would be the purpose to avoid criminal liability. And the facts that you gave. Again, I'm trying to come up, see the difference between A purpose versus E purpose. I'm not sure if that fact pattern you just gave illustrates
it. Okay, then I want to go back to Paul's.
Okay.
So, but it sounds like the answer is in mine, as long as A purpose is
Yeah. To avoid, again, this is something I have to think for. We all have to think further about.
Is the bartender guilty?
I thought the bartender would not be guilty. So what's
the answer? The bartender would.
So the bartender had two purposes. One, she was busy, so she didn't feel like asking for her ID. And B, she realized there was a risk that the person was under age.
And so therefore, she avoided asking for it so that she could not be convicted.
Well, she had two reasons.
Right.
One reason was to avoid responsibility.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, I think. As it currently reads, I think it's unclear. It's something
that,
definitely consider.
That goes to Laura's question about whether it's a reason or the reason, right? Because if it's a reason, then she would be guilty. But if it's the reason, then maybe she wouldn't be guilty because it wasn't the reason.
No.
When you were talking about it,
right?
When Paul first, you sort of said something about the sole reason, or I think you said sole, but even primary.
Yeah.
Might make me feel better, but. So you described it as if the meant the, and I was, oh, maybe I won't even ask my question. But it sounds like when posed with the hypo of, I have two reasons.
Right. Yeah, so what I'd
or
say.
Or three. I have three reasons, as it turns out, and so it's not even a half. It's less than a half of one of the reasons.
Right. Yeah, so I'd say that it's ambiguous as drafted, and it's something. Well, definitely consider it. It's interesting.
I'm going to comment on the topic.
So yeah. The flip of that is, I understand their uncomfortableness with it.
Right.
But that would negate a lot of our law. If a bartender merely needs to come up with any other reason other than checking their age, then there's no reason for the city council to have a thing about underage drinking, a law about it.
Right.
Because you could always come up with another reason why you did it, in addition to purposely not asking for the person's age
to avoid
the crime.
You could just say if you're reckless about the element rather than having knowledge.
Right, exactly. You can always, so it's worth noting how narrow what we're talking about here. The legislature always has the ability to simply describe the mens rea of an offense as reckless. And that obviates the question.
Yeah, but the problem is we're doing this in a vacuum in a sense. Because for me to say, yes, I vote with the reason as opposed to A, because the city council can always add recklessness, means that every time I see this issue, I have to point that out to the council, and what's the likelihood of the council doing reckless, and everybody agreeing that recklessness is the standard as opposed to knowledge.
But that's exactly what's happening.
That's the good part.
Yeah.
Good part
I don't know.
Well, and also, just to be clear.
I think if you have a standard that says, that if it is a reason,
So this is
it's willful blindness.
So
as opposed to the only reason is willful blindness. I think that solves the issue as well.
And
gives then the city council more choices on the knowledge element for various offenses.
So two things. One is, I would just say, so for example, the proposed solution to voluntary intoxication is contingent upon recklessness. It's not, so the idea of having a culpability regime based around certain choices in mental states is inherent kind of in modern penal code drafting.
Yeah.
So that's one. Two, again, the distinction between a purpose versus the purpose was not something that popped out in terms of looking at case law, looking at, outside the district. Inside the district, there's next to nothing on this. But it's something we'll definitely consider, be prepared to talk about at the next meeting.
So maybe I'm wrong, which is why I wanted to talk to someone who would keep my secrets as opposed to whatever. But it still strikes me as a sliding scale. Like, I'm not saying I couldn't live with a purpose, but then I want the circumstance. I hear what you're saying. I feel like I want the circumstance to be more likely to be true. But if there's a million sort of explanations, I mean, the problem with Paul's example is there's actually probably a good reason to think that she is underage. But if there's sort of like lots of indications she might be, and if she is, that's a big deal, and I kind of want to check. But there's also somebody who checks ID at the door. There's like lots of things that also could indicate there's other reasons why this kind of young-looking person, right, is here ordering a drink, right? That there are legal possibilities. I sort of feel like I could live with a reason being the standard, a purpose, I think, if one of the scenarios was, but it better really be a good likelihood that the illegal thing is happening. I think.
So recklessness is a substantial likelihood.
But
so your general point is absolutely right, which is that culpability, like our intuitive assessments of how culpable people are operating a sliding scale, and there's really like two axes. One is the level of risk, and the other is the reasons for imposing that risk. And so, generally speaking, the worse a reason and the higher the risk, the more culpable someone seems. So I think you could see how the higher the risk goes, let's say, the narrower you'd want the reason requirement to be versus the broader, the lower down it goes. It's hard to codify that. There's a certain, you're limited in terms of how many distinctions you can make. As a matter of just historical practice, this willful blindness situation where really the sort of the classic case of willful blindness is where people structure a organizational crime in a way so as to avoid getting that guilty knowledge. That's kind of what the focus is towards. Whereas, let's say, just having a bartender who's feeling lazy or whatever on any given night, or is perhaps trying to impress someone, whatever. There's a whole host of reasons why any given person, would not follow up to confirm or investigate. Also, there's just, you can draft offenses that specifically address the particular issue. So you could draft an offense, dealing with ID checks, just laying out what the bartender's obligations are. But again, it's an interesting point and something we'll consider.
I agree with Laura, though, but it's got to be a sliding scale. Because even in your example, there's a difference between Great Aunt Sadie saying, take this across the border, and the guy you knew from high school who dropped out because he was selling drugs saying, take this across the border. Right?
Right.
And so between those two extremes, there's got to be some gray area in the middle where a jury's either going to believe whether the person truly was ducking out on not asking the right question, or whether it was moving towards, great aunt's situation.
Right.
It's got to be.
So what I want to think more about is what you said to me, but I think this is actually exactly where I am. You said, my situation, you weren't even sure it gets to reckless. And that is the high probability. That is exactly what we're talking about, right? We're talking about a high probability.
Which is greater than a substantial risk.
Right, but that is this number one. It's just you chose reckless, and as opposed to the person, whatever, consciously disregarded a high probability that the circumstance existed. That's right.
That was
okay,
a choice.
So I need to.
Yeah, so there are okay. There are kind of like two decisions. So in the common law development here, so I think in the federal courts of appeal, I think there's a circuit split as to whether the preservation of a defense being the purpose, whether or not that is a required element of willful blindness. On the other hand, there's also disagreement as to the level of risk necessary. So what we ended up going with was kind of a middle ground approach, which I think ultimately better captures most intuitions on willful blindness, which is to take the lower side of the risk scale, but to take a much narrower view of the reason scale, because again, in at least some jurisdictions, it's not even a question of reason. It's just, exactly. So you know, it's in that grandma situation, right?
I need to take my win and run.
Yeah, basically.
We'll see. I might have to.
Yeah. So you know, the motivation behind the purpose requirement is to avoid that whole slew of unintuitive outcomes. But again, as you're pointing out,
okay.
One could argue perhaps, you know, the choice between whether it's a purpose or the purpose or how you construe that will have even further implications. It wasn't something we considered.
Okay.
Yeah. I think Dave is right that it is hard to think about this in a vacuum, so it might be helpful. We could have like specific statutes that require knowledge of an attendant circumstance to think about how they would come out differently.
So I say drug. Like, so currently our drug statutes, I can't speak to what the revised ones are going to look like, but our current district drug statutes require knowledge as to the nature of the substance.
And so does
sexual
the bullets.
I'm sorry?
The
ammunition. Unlawful ammunition.
Right.
No. The worst bullets, the bad bullets. Come on.
The armor piercing?
Yes.
The armor piercing.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that's a higher standard.
And our equivalent of statutory rape.
Well, and also RSP, which is the offense in which willful blindness doctrine. So you have this RSP statute, which talks about either knowing or having reason to believe. A recent, I think it was Owens, a 2014 opinion, held that the having reason to believe language means willful blindness. So it's knowing or willful blindness, but there's not like a lot of clarification as to what the contours of that alternative to knowledge willful blindness would be.
I have an intoxication question.
Come on, let's hear it.
Self-induced.
Sure.
I.
What? Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
It's that at the very end of the memo. I'm partly showing off what I got.
Go ahead. Let's see. Let's see the fancy footwork.
I also do want to register that I always resent discussing this, and there are no props. but here it is. Just bullets. It struck me the whole time I was reading it that self-induced, you say at the end, still you, right?
Yeah.
That you sort of don't define it, you get it's, you know, the difference between self-induced and involuntary, and you sort of say that ends up being a little complicated. It troubled me the whole way through, however.
Sure.
Because it seemed then at the end that you felt like self-induced was the same as voluntary, and I thought, I think it's not. So I thought of the example of I don't know that voluntary captures it. It's why I think I'd want a definition, some kind of definition, where I take pills consciously.
Right,
like
no. Yeah, sure,
it,
sure.
But I don't realize how they're going to work together.
Sure.
Uh-huh. And, right, so all this, like, you were drinking, how did you not realize
sure.
the problem here? Yeah. But I don't actually know what happens until I'm in it.
Yeah.
Is I'm about to be intoxicated.
Right. So a few things there. It's a great point. It was also a point Dave raised when we met with him last week. So first of all, the choice to just use the phrase self-induced over the term voluntary was a pure drafting choice because we have the term voluntary already used and defined as product of effort determination. It's not super helpful in this context, so we just wanted to avoid that overlap. The model penal code and modern criminal codes often use the phrase self-induced, but some use voluntary. So yeah. Now, apart from the terminological issue, the right, how you define self-induced intoxication, that is to say what self-induced means, there's a variety of significant policy issues that fall under there. You named one, which is you took the substance, but you didn't know ultimately what effect it was going to have. There's another situation where you took the substance, you expected one effect, you ended up with a different effect. There's another situation where through duress, you know, someone puts a gun to your head or something less and says, drink or else, you do. There's a whole spectrum of policy issues. Now, the model penal code offers a definition. We found that definition to be less than satisfying for a few different reasons, and also there's only about 6 or 7 jurisdictions that even adopted it. And so the choice here was just to say that those issues are ultimately going to be delegated to the courts to resolve. You know, in drafting any code, you have to pick and choose what issues you're going to resolve and what you're not going to resolve. And in the absence of a sort of satisfying, clear resolution of all these contours, you know, on this issue, we said probably best to leave it. That being said, we definitely could consider, you know, adopting the model penal code definition as well.
Because I guess I don't understand structurally why our court would be better equipped than us. If we're advising a legislative body in
sure.
policy determination, it seemed like it'd be better for us than for an ad hoc court.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's true on any issue. The question is just, you know, if we're going to tackle it, so that's something we can do, but you know, there's a whole host of issues to consider, and no clear model for, at least based upon our own analysis up until this point, that sort of satisfyingly resolves all of them.
But a judge would be faced with that same issue, right?
Sure. Now, it was as far as I can tell, the issue has never come up. There's no reported DCCA opinions on this issue, as far as I can tell. Now, again, because DCCA publishes so few opinions, that's not necessarily a guide to whether or not the issue arises. Also, I don't think there's any mention in the Red Book of it. But there is some case law across the country dealing with these, and if that's something the CRAG members think is important to address, I think it's definitely something we can address. I will just highlight one of the challenges. So the model penal code definition, I think, is knowingly introduces substances that the person knows or ought to know its intoxicating effect, something along those lines. And that's basically the definition as far as I know, it's only been adopted 6 or 7 places, and no one's really modified it. So that basically sets negligence, ought to know, as the basis for determining whether or not it's self-induced. Yet, in effect, here what you essentially have is a imputation of recklessness. So it would seem as though the more proportionate approach would be to boost at least to recklessness, one's awareness of the intoxicating effect, but there is no precedent. You know, there's no current precedent for that. So that's one thing. There's also
so my question is, if we leave it to a judge, like where would she get the tools to make that decision?
Sure.
How would she know what to do?
Yeah. No. I mean, it's up until this point, the DCCA has essentially been operating as quasi-legislature on every culpability issue in the district.
Except I feel like once we set it up as if we're answering questions, then we actually have to answer the questions.
Sure.
Like, I feel like the answer is a judge will be like, sorry, turns out you don't get that. Like, you're not going to get to talk about intoxication because you took the pills. So here we are. Like, I feel like they won't grapple with what self-induced means because we write it as if this is the answer unless somewhere in there it's going to say, you know, we actually haven't answered what actually self-interest means.
Right.
I mean, I have to think, I feel like there's steps. I hear what you're saying. I'm not as good at this, like, imputing this automatically means it's this level. Because I feel like I don't get to the recklessness, imputation of recklessness, until I go to the first step of the negligence.
Yeah.
And I feel like, yes, I took this pill, and it turns out when you also take fish oil, what happens to Bayer aspirin is, wow, it makes you high. But who knew? And that's the point. Right. Who knew?
Oh, I'm sorry, I should just say.
So when you get to that.
That's not actually true.
Well, how would you know? We're not doing science.
With a lot of people wasting time money on scuba snacks.
There's another really significant policy issue. Perhaps even. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Don.
Oh, so I was just going to say where there's the ambiguity in how this is structured. The application matters a lot, and so there's a, if you kind of look at the historical trend in nearby jurisdictions where, or in any jurisdiction, where they've tried to figure out what to do about, and almost all of the shift in the intoxication world comes from a shift in a perception about drunk driving. Right, Mothers Against Drunk Driving basically drove the policy change around the self-intoxication defense. It used to be the case in the United States that if you were intoxicated and you got into an accident, you weren't blamed, and via this, you are blamed far more often. And there are two approaches, one that relies on the judiciary and one that relies on the legislature. The legislative approach is typically one that carves out a new statute for vehicular homicide and has a kind of specific language about intoxication, and that turns out to be a lower offense than the unintoxicated intentional vehicular homicide, right? And so that's because that's just homicide. And so that's one way, and it tends to reduce the penalty associated with the main group that this type of innovation is applied to, which is drunk drivers. The other way is through the judicial response. And the judicial response can drive the legislative response. So where the judiciary basically has said, sorry, the person was intoxicated and therefore that negated the requirement of purposefulness for the particular homicide that the prosecutor was looking at, the legislature was willing to step in and draft this type of moderate statute that was somewhere between no penalty and the most serious penalty that the judges and the judiciary would establish. In the jurisdictions where the default was to provide full liability for intoxicated homicides, the legislature doesn't adopt that more moderate approach. And I'm not saying which policy is the right policy, but I think it's helpful to know that if you have a policy that is more far-reaching and a little bit more punitive, it makes it very hard for the legislature to then subsequently come back and alter it. And so the legislature is almost always willing to step in where they see criminal underreach or under penalization, right? It's what they live for. It's a happy day in every legislator's life when they get to say, like, I have identified a crime that is not punished enough, and I have a new bill. And so if there is a risk of accidentally nudging in one direction or the other, making a mistake in one direction or the other, I think it is worth thinking hard about it. Just to have that in the back of your head as you're thinking about what the label should be. And again, I don't actually have a very good sense of which policy is the correct policy. I just know that if you make a mistake in one direction, it's far less likely to be corrected further on down the line.
I had thought that other than the examples you gave, that where this really came out the most often for intoxication was the difference between specific intent and general intent crimes.
Right.
And how intoxication knocked you out of the specific intent into the general intent, which was usually a lesser included, and
yeah,
carried so a lower and carried a lower penalty.
There's a few different things we're talking about. There are specific intoxication statutes, particularly driving while intoxicated,
yeah, yeah.
or we have like a vehicular homicide,
sure.
which deals with that.
With alcohol as
right,
an element.
Right, with that issue. Even outside that context, you just have a general culpability question across all offenses, which is how do you deal with claims of intoxication? Common law approach was to divvy up crimes to general intent, specific
yeah.
intent, based on no real principle. Also, it's ultimately just a sort of case-by-case judicial policy decision that was being made on no particular principle. And also didn't really clarify what the actual mechanics of it were. Now, I would just say how you define self-induced intoxication, even the common law, I recognize the distinction between involuntary and voluntary or involuntary and self-induced intoxication. But how you define that category, which Laura was highlighting, is kind of distinct in a way from whatever your approach is. You still are going to need to figure out what types of intoxication count versus don't count. And in addition to the policy questions you raised, probably the biggest is what happens when it's pursuant to medical advice, right? So the doctor tells you to take Xanax in the evening, and then you go drive, and you get in an accident. Is that self-induced? Or should that fall within the realm of inclusion and exclusion in terms of this recklessness imputation? The same question also arises if you're going general intent versus specific intent. Whether or not you're going to apply that distinction in the first place hinges upon a threshold decision, as is this the type of intoxication that we care about? And so, if CRAG members think that this is a policy issue, that is important to deal with and to resolve, and it seems like something that we can come up with a satisfying solution for, then we should go ahead and do it.
The doctor example doesn't bother me, right? Because I sort of feel like that's the next step, right? That's why you're imputing the recklessness to me. I took the Xanax. I mean, I don't know, does the doctor telling me to take it mean, presumably, well, I guess it depends on why the doctor's telling me to take
right.
it, right? If the doctor's like, it's a miracle cancer drug, as opposed to it'll, if the reason it's being prescribed to me is the effect of basically being intoxicated and then I drive the car, then yeah,
and
that's a problem.
And under
but
current law, it's clear what law is. You take the Xanax, but you better not drive.
Okay, what does
right,
Xanax do? Isn't it it's
motor impairment. Yeah,
well, there you go.
So just
but
general
then, but
impairment.
That's why the doctor probably prescribed it, right? As opposed to your dandruff is out of control. Here's Xanax, right?
Right.
So then I don't realize it's got
yes.
this other issue.
And so part of the issue here is coming
here or not, aren't you? No, you knew. I made that up.
Part of the challenge in coming up with a fully satisfying definition of self-induced is coming up with principles that can address the whole host of situations that we're talking about. Because you want to distinguish between the reasons for which medical advice, or the content of medical advice, there are distinctions between the level of culpability that someone had in terms of their getting intoxication, both whether it would intoxicate and the extent to which they're interacting. There's just a...
But I feel like your model penal code definition actually takes care of the doctor example.
Well, it says straightforward, unless pursuant to medical advice, so it's...
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't remember you saying that.
But yeah, sorry, that was the...
I kind of know what's going to happen, right? What did it have to do with a sort of ought to know the effect it's going to have?
Right, but then there's a clause, comma, unless given pursuant to medical advice or taken under, and then it relies on the Model Penal Code's affirmative defense definitions, which is to say, like, under conditions that would otherwise provide the basis for a general defense, alluding to, like, duress and some others, then also it doesn't count as, then it's not self-induced. Which is just to say, there's a whole panoply of issues falling under this.
Okay, but I feel like that is worth a conversation about the medical thing, but otherwise I like the definition. I'm thinking of things I forgot to say.
Can I ask just a real simple question? I'm just still trying to see how this stuff plays out on a very basic level.
Absolutely.
So you get a person who, I want to kill somebody, and I know, I want to get confidence before I go out there, so I'm going to do a couple of shots at Jack Daniels before I go and shoot him. Right. But I'm also aware that when I drink, my aim gets a lot worse.
Okay.
All right? So both of those things are in my head. With that, if I drink alcohol, would that be a distinction in my knowledge, whether it's purposeful or knowledge or the standards? I was trying to play those throughout.
Yeah.
Because in one case, right? So to me, that's a distinction between purpose and knowledge. Am I understanding that correctly?
So the distinction between purpose and knowledge, purpose is a conscious desire.
That's
and
right.
Knowledge is awareness as to practical certainty that a result would occur.
Right. So I don't think it would go to purpose or knowledge. Again, the classic example that's helpful for me in thinking about the difference there is if you want to kill your partner and you put a bomb in an airplane to kill him, you're purposeful with regard to him. If you know everybody else is going to die, you're knowledgeable with regard to them, even though you don't have the purpose. So, and at least the Model Penal Code punishes purpose and knowledge pretty much the same because they feel like you're pretty much as culpable. Recklessness, I mean, I kind of like the way the Model Penal Code handles that with regard to intoxication, because what it says is if you're not reckless under the formal definition, that is, you don't appreciate a risk, but the reason you don't appreciate the risk is because you're intoxicated, then that counts as recklessness.
And that's how that's what this
And again,
is.
I know that, we could talk later, but what catches me with that example is I am consciously desiring to cause a result. I'm drinking the alcohol, but I'm shooting at you because I want to kill you. On the other hand, am I practically certain that my conduct will kill you because I know my aim is for garbage drink a lot?
So here's what I say, Dave. Yeah, so purpose is the most... So those two things. One, purpose is the most culpable mental state in the hierarchy. Purpose will suffice for any offense.
So if I do that, am I satisfying purpose or knowledge in the example I
gave? So, look, that is a factual question. So this provision only speaks to the relevance of intoxication in a narrow sense, the extent to which it negates a particular culpable mental state. Under your hypothetical, it seems to me that at the moment the person is shooting the gun, they consciously desire to cause that end of story purpose.
Okay.
But I don't see any reason, just because you take a few drinks, you would have to hit a tremendously high level of intoxication, I think, to get to a point where if you're shooting a gun at point blank range at someone's head, that you're not practically certain.
Yeah, I wasn't saying point blank. I was just saying shooting.
Right. I mean, but again, the short answer is perfect. Because the person consciously desires, that's it. That's purpose.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry. I've got to go. Thanks.
Thanks.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Just to kind of engage with the group where we are, is there a lot more that people want to ask about report number 3, or should we continue with intoxication, or do people have a lot of questions about report number 4? Like, what?
We went out of order, and I thought BC was leaving, and then Laura jumped to intoxication. So I would have started at the beginning and sort of worked our way through it. In other words, I know Paul was leaving, so I figured Paul was raising his issues
first.
This is totally fine. Do people have burning questions about report number 4 they want to jump to, or should we keep talking about report number 3? Because we're doing report number 3.
What I'm saying is
report
we have
number 3.
Yeah.
Oh, 4. Oh, okay.
I just wondered.
No, I'm saying we didn't get a chance to go through report number three in my mind
yeah.
because we knew Paul was leaving early. Paul started with Paul's question. I didn't interrupt and go, what about page four?
I think it's totally fine that we spend more time on report number three. I just wanted to kind of gauge the interest of the
Give me a second and
let us
go through it. There may be...
It sounds like this is probably the juicier stuff anyway than report number four. I just wanted to kind of...
Yeah, I found it was a lot more in three than in four.
There's no rush. We can spend more time on report number three. I just wanted to make sure that that was what people thought.
Footnote 94. Okay, yes, I skipped the footnotes, but I read the whole thing. The main part.
But I guess on the subject of involuntary intoxication, is there more that we should discuss about this now, or does it sound like we have a few things we're going to be looking at before the next meeting?
So you want to go back to intoxication?
I think we should just, go, whatever,
Yeah, we can go back, sure.
Okay, and...
Whatever, we're here until...
Whatever, we're here until
four,
whatever.
So...
I just wanted to make sure people, we're getting a lot of this, it sounds like we are, so that's good.
I actually have to leave in about 5 minutes. Are you going to, how'd you talk?
Certainly.
Do you guys want to talk about that first?
No, I think because it's an informal discussion, I think she's, if you're okay with that, but for anything more formal, I think Richard does require the written letter. But I think that's, if you're okay with that, then that's fine.
I'll be very quiet.
Yeah, just you can't raise your voice. That's the...
I'm happy to listen.
What was the question? I'm sorry. I zoned out. Whether you can talk?
Seems important.
This does kind of go back to something that Dave had mentioned briefly prior to everyone being here in the recording about what would be going in people's written comments, because basically things that are discussed in these meetings are very helpful, but in terms of what OAG or PDS recommends, comments in here are not binding. It's what goes in the writing. So for informal discussion purposes, I think it's fine if Katia is here, but for anything more, it would have
I to don't be. Have an objection to her voicing.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
You don't listen to us anyway, so what difference does it make?
I hear you, Dave.
I'm cut to the quick. You could do worse here.
Yes, I
know. Okay, I'm sorry. Just
tell me the page.
I'm trying to find
those
which
my,
of these. I've got a lot of notes and scribbles, and I also met with some people last week. So I'm trying to decide what it is that I really think we need. I'm sorry, I didn't have time to outline my previous discussions to see.
So by the way, Laura, I should just say, if there is whether it's MPC definition or any other definition of intoxication, of self-induced intoxication that you think would enhance the statute, you should definitely put that in your comments. That would be a perfect example of something,
that a person could put in their comments.
Could put in their comments, yeah.
I write best after a couple of drinks. Where does that fit into?
Was it pursuant to medical? Are those prescribed drinks? And is it eggnog? Is it the eggnog or the punch bowl? The punch bowl. I say Renata, for a conversation on intoxication, I'd expect a little bit more.
This is being recorded.
Okay, got it. Yeah. All right.
That's being recorded.
All right.
Was it something else in intoxication, Dave?
No, I haven't gotten to intoxication. It was an imputation of knowledge. That's what I was saying. You kept saying intoxication, so that's what I was saying. Do you want to go back to intoxication, or should I start back? Just give me 1 second, because there was one question about the report. It was how do I understand this? Not a... Oh, here it is. On page 22 of the report, so this is just a question of what you guys meant. It talks about subjective belief required for the imputation is proof of recklessness as defined in 206C2 will suffice. Right? That's what you put in the report on page 22. But under 208C1, the person must be reckless with respect to the circumstance, which under the proposed definitions requires awareness of a substantial risk, 206C2, and that the conduct that grossly deviates from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the person's situation.
Right.
Am I right about those?
You are right that...
The comment doesn't go far enough because it merely reflects...
This is just talking in the context... You're talking about the analysis of nationwide legal trends? This is just specifically discussing the subjective belief requirement.
So you're saying I don't read 22208C1 when I'm analyzing it on page 22. Just want to make sure. Because we talk about recklessness under 22208C1.
Right. So that paragraph 22. is in the context of discussing the choice in awareness. And it's saying that rather than requiring high probability, a lesser standard
blindness.
For willful blindness,
okay.
A lesser standard of substantial risk, i.e. recklessness.
As defined in 206C2.
Right.
Okay, never mind. I'm good.
Sorry, was there a typo here?
No, no, I was wondering whether, why did I read 22... Do you have 22208C1?
Yes.
That was the part, I was trying to read them together, and
sure.
That was, and ended up confusing myself.
I think that's
208C1.
Okay.
Okay, that's that. So why was I... It established that insofar as the subjective C1 reflects the latter, less the many, it establishes insofar as... I may have to just get back to you guys, because I don't remember.
How do we find culpable mental states?
How do we define culpable mental states? There is a definition to be originally pulled. Section 22A206, I think. No, 205. Couple mental states defined.
Okay, so
corpus is... Bye, thank you.
Strict liability means like... So strict liability is technically... We talk about it there, but it's not technically a culpable mental state. Am I right about
that? Strict liability is the absence of a culpable mental state.
It got pulled out. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Which is actually why I thought your example before was
And that's why I was thinking about the fact. So go back to where we were in the 208C, and that is right. Because it says... When a culpable mental state of knowledge applies to a circumstance. So, for example, statutory rape,
where the state of
age is not a defense,
right.
Because it's a strict liability,
you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, so that's what I was...
Yes, that's right.
That's what I was thinking through.
That is correct.
Got it.
Statutory rape and the relationship.
Right.
And under this framework,
you can always say it is not a defense, but the counsel can also just say, in fact, of a certain age, and that is clearly signifies under.
Well, right, and the in fact
exactly.
is a trigger for
strict liability.
Strict liability.
Yeah.
Which means, okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is why you don't have the.
That's exactly right.
Oh, and one of the things that I brought up, just so my other commissioners, I don't know what we are, advisory board members know. But what I discussed with Richard last week and Michael was whether in 22A209, I understand why negligence was not put there. Within that section on a philosophical basis, but I still think for you guys to think about whether we should reference negligence there merely because we're talking about the mental states, and it looks odd to somebody who doesn't understand this why we're missing a mental state.
Sure. So the explanatory note does...
It goes into it, but it just looks odd when you're looking at it and you only see three of the four. And my suggestion was to add something, even if it's
on negligence,
even if it's a disclaimer about how it affects.
I think that's...
That was one of my suggestions. So you guys can think about that for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, so
it's
we'll
on page 25.
There is one similarity between this issue and the definition of self-induced intoxication, which is to say when at a certain point you come across incredibly tricky issues where it can be particularly fact-sensitive or raise a whole host that just as a co-drafter you just have to make the decision where to invest time in terms of what you think you can come up with a sort of comprehensive, fair solution versus what you end up leaving to case-specific resolution. Mm-hmm. Both the meaning of self-induced and the contour, the particularities of the role that intoxication, how it gets incorporated and evaluated through the lens of negligence, are both those kinds of issues. There's a general language in the explanatory note kind of flagging it. You can either be more upfront about it statutorily or even try to solve it.
Yeah, I'm...
How does negligence now fit in?
So the explanatory note highlights, let's see, that... Negligence generally cannot be negated by intoxication. And the generally there is because... You know, there are a range of situations where, because you know what you're talking about is you're comparing to the reasonable person. You're looking for like a gross deviation, and maybe let's set aside driving, but you know, just someone is whether it's they're hitting a baseball bat and hitting balls on a field or whatever. Has a drink, two drinks, is it always going to be the gross deviation from the reasonable sober person, even if having a drink in this situation is perfectly reasonable? You know, like, so you can say that. I mean, it's a value judgment as to how much you do or do not want to individualize the reasonableness standard. Another complication would be, let's say the intoxication was involuntary, but it was only like a drink. Let's say your frat, at a fraternity party, the frat brothers force one of the younger fraternity to have a drink, and then the person goes out and commits a particular offense. In that situation, when you're doing this gross deviation analysis, which is really just asking, was it grossly unreasonable? Are you comparing, in that situation, do you take into account the person's situation or not? There's just a spectrum of issues there, similar to the question of what self-induced means, where, you can either try and resolve it or not, or, so...
I don't think I have anything else in here. Before we get to intoxication.
So I guess I think I need to study this a little bit more because I thought I understood you and Paul to be having a conversation where I concluded that an approach that says intoxication can negate a culpable mental state, unless, for example, in the context of, I guess it has to be recklessness.
That's right.
You can't recognize the risk or appreciate the risk because of
your
intoxication.
That's right.
All right, so that is consistent because the only one where intoxication can still render you liable is with respect to recklessness, but it does negate with respect to purpose and
but
knowledge.
But only when it does. So first of all, that is current DCCA case law as well, which is to say that one can have a drink or 10 or 20 and go out and intentionally kill someone. It is not that by being intoxicated, you necessarily
don't have
it. What this is saying is, and again, this is trying to more or less mirror to the greatest extent possible the common law approach, which is reflecting the district, is when purpose or knowledge is at issue, the defendant, if the reason why the government can't prove that, or let me phrase it like this, intoxication is relevant there if, because of that person's intoxicated state, the person just lacked the culpable mental state required by an offense.
Which is why I think how this plays out in the actual offenses really matter, right? Some offenses we've already built this in, right? First degree murder, what your intent is for first degree is different than as you work your way down the list of homicides, really fits, I think, well with this kind of a system, right? What your mental state was. I don't know that all crimes
do that, sort of.
So that's why I'm still trying to think these through with different classes of crime.
Right.
Right. It's easy for me to say, okay, first degree murder, you need this mental state. Some future second or third, you need different mental states as you work it down with different penalties associated.
So, just to sort of piggyback off of current district law, although the match is not perfect because you're dealing in an offense analysis jurisdiction that's not making element distinctions and not particularly clear on mental state. That being said, as a general matter, specific intent offenses to which intoxication may serve as a defense, which really means when it precludes a government from meeting its burden of proof with respect to purpose or intent beyond a reasonable doubt, generally translate to offenses that, as a matter of practice, require proof of purpose or knowledge.
That's right.
So two general intent offenses often are offenses to which recklessness is, or something equivalent to it. So for example, like malice. Yeah, so malice is essentially purposely, knowingly, or recklessly. Maybe it's like an extreme, in some situations it's an extreme version of recklessly, but the point there being is that in those situations, then it's not that intoxication is necessarily a defense, it's just that here it can be, the government has two options. It can either prove the standard mental state with intoxication evidence, or it can prove negligence plus self-induced intoxication. So there are a few places highlighted in the memo under current law where the DCCA has deemed an offense to be one of general intent, but then seems to require, as a matter of practice, proof of knowledge. I think it's like TBWR, maybe distribution,
UUV.
And UUV.
It's TBWR.
Taking property without right.
Right.
Sorry.
Rarely charged.
Yeah. I was going to say, not one of our big ones.
No shame in not knowing what that was off the top of your head.
As opposed to receiving property, which is a lot easier to prove.
Yeah, I dare somebody come up with a very quick hypo even on it.
For what?
TBWR.
Oh, yeah.
Extortion.
Yeah. So those are offenses where, as a matter of practice, case law requires knowledge, but also the DCCA has classified the offense as a general intent offense. So those are we call those like non-conforming offenses. Those would kind of be like, in terms of changes to district law, potentially the most significant offenses, but it's worth noting that, you know, there's different options there, one of which is to apply a recklessness mental state, because once you've applied the recklessness mental state instead of a knowledge mental state, that sweeps in all of the intoxication principles. You know, another is you can make offense-specific exceptions to intoxication rules, not, generally speaking, not, like, preferable, unless there's, like, a real reason for it, like a principled reason.
Which, yeah, I mean, but that's why I thought the examples were bad before, because there's a difference between talking about intoxication when intoxication is an element of an offense and talking about intoxication just dealing with mental states.
Yeah, so that's
what they need to be separated.
Right, and that's what the whole memo, everything in
here,
no,
I agree.
Just
I don't
dealing
have
with
that.
The mental states
yeah,
version.
Yeah, that's right.
You're right. Yeah, to be honest, we didn't.
That's why I didn't like vehicular homicide, you know.
Right.
And DWI is examples for things.
Yeah, and as far as I understand, those offenses are kind of strict liability in that all the government needs to prove is intoxication plus causation.
That's right.
Right.
Which is so, why I was saying the example of the Xanax was not, it's not the case that you adopt a prescribing and it gets you out. The mere fact
sure,
that you,
that's right.
You may have to take it for your cancer. What that means is if you take it, don't drive.
Got
it's it. Not that you get to drive and you get an out because your doctor prescribed.
Sure, sure. As far as I understand, those offenses are not under our current scope of review.
Well, at least impaired driving is it? That's
yeah.
Title 50.
Right.
I don't know about the homicide,
right.
You know.
So,
about negligent homicide.
Yeah, but vehicular homicide is not. Does it say anything about intoxication or just causing a death?
No, that's
driving?
Just like you negligently
yeah.
caused
yeah,
death
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
while operating a vehicle.
Right. Yeah. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else.
So is that everything yeah. for report number three then?
Yes.
All right, so we can turn to report number four. I will pull that up, and if there are any questions on that, Bryson would be happy to answer.
Yeah, the short title. No.
Yeah.
Why did we shorten the short title? Oh, by the way, I like that the effective date was a year from enactment. I think that's conservative in training people, training judges, prosecutors,
yeah.
and defense upon the dead man. I don't know if I have a question about this, but I'll mention it to see if it sparks conversation. On page 2, you say, to resolve this ambiguity and fill the gap in district law, states that if a single element of a crime is committed before the effective date.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to think of examples where some element of an offense, no matter how minor, can occur prior. And how that actually ends up playing. I was trying to figure out how that actually works in practice.
Probably aren't many offenses where that's going to happen. But yeah, conspiracy, fraud.
Accessory before the fact? If it spans the 24-hour period?
I don't know. Yeah, exactly.
If we even have that?
Yeah, there's also things like possession is a weird one, right? Because possession is sort of continuous. So it kind of, I guess, depends on whether
so
you're indicting possession
you have
before or after.
So maybe you have permission to be in possession of a vehicle at some point, but then it ends.
So how about ongoing offenses would be the old law, right?
Ongoing
anything like a fraud. Right, because a fraud is a continuing
exactly
can be a continuing thing. So if it starts in 2020 and ends in 2021, and say that's where it enacts, then that would be under old law.
Yep.
What about for the theory of liability, where the theory of liability is conspiracy? It's not charged as conspiracy to commit murder, but it's just the theory for the homicide is conspiracy, and so that falls before.
Like Pinkerton.
Yeah.
Okay.
The jury gets conspiracy liability instruction, and that conspiracy falls entirely before.
Yeah, so conspiracy in terms of like stuff that is I think like next in the queue. These are, I mean, generally thought about, but definitely I think something to consider.
Just in terms of the effective.
Yeah,
I think that it would, again, like the way that's written right now. If there's any element
But it's often not an element.
It's not an element.
It is not an element, but I think...
It's just but the theory of liability predates the... which they have to establish to have that theory of liability go back.
I guess it would depend on how we're doing conspiracy with respect to that, right? Because that sounds like it's an element then, even if it's not an element. If it has to be established by the government beyond reasonable doubt, I don't see any difference. You know what I mean?
But it sounds like it's almost ex post facto, so if we use the new law rather than the old one.
Right.
If the theory of conspiracy changes, but it's based on conspiracy...
No, so ex post facto only works if you're doing something that wasn't illegal before and imposing it to, right, prior to that behavior.
So we have to use the old theory of conspiracy.
Exactly, you have to use the old theory. That's right.
What was in place at the time?
Yeah, really, you know, the ex post facto clause only, as I understand it, only operates when there's a detriment to the defendant. So if there's a benefit to the defendant, you can ex post facto all you wish. This just sets the rule saying...
So in her hypo, just to play this all out,
for sure,
you would be charged for the element under the current crime, but the conspiracy theory would be how conspiracy existed under the pre-enactment date.
I don't think so. And this might be just because I'm not familiar with this conspiracy theory, this form of liability.
You can have a secondary murder that's where the jury also has to find conspiracy, and it's not a standalone charge. It's just a theory of liability.
Right. So Pinkerton, right? Like, you and I form a conspiracy. You go kill the person. I don't have anything to do with that killing. My understanding is that I can be liable for that murder.
Right.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, yeah, there'd be two things. First, my initial kind of reaction to that is it sounds like it's still an element. It may not be an element of second-degree murder, per se, but it sounds like it's something that has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt by the government. And the second thing is, like, again, this would probably be more of a question for when we start looking at conspiracy liability in general.
Is it not elements facts that satisfy an element if they occur prior to?
Yeah, so if one of the offense elements, so let's go back to the language, let's read it. But yeah, one of the offense elements happens prior to the effective date. Then we should be operating under the current law or the old law at that point.
So
I think it would be probably more of a question for when we get to conspiracy, which
I was just going to say that I know that conspiracy duration is like a complex policy issue, and that perhaps once we do that, we'll have a little bit more insight to how particularly that would play out on this. But it definitely seems like something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as like current law and how this works, because there is a general savings statute that we have, it's not specific about whether, right, you have to do one element or no elements or two, three elements or something like that. So this statute does kind of deviate insofar as it actually specifies single element. Doesn't have to work that way. That's just the way that the MVC does it. It seems like the most sensible way to do it. And also, you know, I mean, can do anything you want with the statute. If there needs to be a carve-out or something for conspiracy or something like that, we can talk about. But it's kind of hard to speculate,
right,
with respect to that charge in particular.
On 22A102, page 3, when you talk about the structure, is that the structure of the code provision?
Yeah.
As opposed to the purpose and history, which are the legislative intent?
Yeah.
Okay.
So structure would be like, you know, it's in this chapter, or the statute before it is referring to something, you know, that kind of
something stuff. Related.
Yeah, it's a semantic.
Okay. And my initial, and I'm going back and forth with whether I was going to bring this up or whether this is an issue, but you said if necessary, and the first thing I wrote down is for what?
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, so I've gone back and forth on whether we need something else after the if necessary?
So that's a really good question. So like the thought from our perspective on this one was after examining the case law on this, we don't know when it's necessary. It doesn't seem like the DCCA knows when it's necessary. So we're not going to take a position.
Okay.
And you know, our general gist on 22A102 is like we just want current law to be in there.
Yeah.
We're not trying to, you know, impose some sort of theory of interpretation.
Okay. I went back and forth. I put it in. I crossed it out.
We did too. Like, this is like the product of like 20 drafts that went through.
Or more.
Like back and forth about how to do this. And so,
infinite drafts.
Again, this would be...
Okay, at this point, I don't have a comment on it. Yeah, I just, you know...
No, it's a good catch, though.
What page are we on now?
That was page three.
Three.
Oh, but going back to what I said before, in the comment, structure is tied to legislative intent, not.
Yeah, no, that's another good point. You know, is structure a part of like plain meaning reading?
Or is it legislative intent? Yeah. So those two are. We may need to just clarify that. I don't know that I have a problem.
Sure. I think that the structure purpose history formula that you see there is drawn from a particular DCCA case, and I don't remember which one in particular, but that kind of magic
I'm not language. Sure I have a strong feeling one way or the other which way it should go, but I think at least it should be
a tipping, clear. I think is the... Sure. So if that is the case, if it were the case, would the recommendation then be to take out structure from that second sentence and move it into the first sentence, or to strike structure from the statute entirely? You know what
no,
I mean?
No, I think I don't have a problem with the structure of the code being an aid to interpretation.
Right, right.
Right? I mean, you know, frequently the council inserts a crime somewhere. And I know that there was one that we actually had some debate on, or at least discussion, about, was it revenge porn? It was one where the city council wanted to put it in one place originally, and we said, no, it'll confuse everybody if you put it in stalking. You really want it over here.
Sure.
And so the structure... Yeah. We thought mattered because we thought that when somebody reviewing it would read it within the context of its structure.
So the question would be, and then, right, is it a first order interpretive
rule? Or is it, and I'm probably fine either way. Okay. I just wanted to be clear which way.
Okay. Yeah, I can take a closer look at that.
Okay. And I might have a case that says you should look at headings and captions.
Oh.
I just saw one. Now I just have to remember if it was a DC. I think it was a DC case. It might not have been. But I think it was a DC case, so I might be able to fill that one in.
Yeah.
That
makes sense. Yeah.
And the other one was what I wish Laura was here for, because this one of those where I don't know that it matters or it's phrased, but in 22A103, I think it should be in this title applies only to this title, as opposed to this title alone.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's clearer, whatever that's worth.
To only this title instead of this
Page
title
seven.
Alone.
Only to this title.
Yeah,
only to this
only in the loan gets like really tricky when you're doing drafting, and usually the better practice is to try and avoid it, right?
Yeah.
It's
But I think that is the point of that.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. So you prefer this
I
title.
I like only.
This title
I like
only.
It applies only to this title.
Oh, applies only to this title. Okay.
So. Unless otherwise prevented by law, the provision in this title applies only to this title?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I would put it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, then that's just I'm not sure it'd be a big court of appeals case over it, but I just think it's clearer to what you're talking about.
Okay.
That was my only stuff.
I mean, it's perfectly clear to me.
Yeah.
It's just that. Interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting. I spent a little while reading, Brian Garner has this Dictionary of Legal Usage and all this stuff. And, read, like, it doesn't matter here, I don't think. I think it's pretty clear. But there are other cases where there is big litigation about where you put only or alone and where it affects, and what particular phrase it affects. So, again, it's another one that we took a look at.
Laura sent me a decision recently that had to do with the placement of a comma.
Good serial commas.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, I don't even understand the argument against serial commas.
The argument against is in a positive phrase. So if you say, everyone likes the Oxford comma except for Ayn Rand, your mother, and God, is kind of like the classic one. It's not clear whether Ayn Rand is your mother, Ayn Rand, your mother.
Do you ever read
Ayn Rand?
If I wrote it there, because if it were Ayn Rand, comma, your mother, my next grammatical punctuation would be a semicolon. I would separate those things so that it becomes clear. So that within the series, you can things separated by commas.
That's exactly right.
And then
the broader series
is separated by semicolons.
Semicolons really establish their authority.
Yes.
Read.
I'm sorry, did I mean to derail?
A great book is Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. Have you ever read it?
It is a fantastic book. Yeah.
It's the only grammar book that I think is fun to read. Eat, Shoots, and Leaves.
Yeah.
Are you eating the shoots?
It's a panda, right?
And the leaves?
Yeah, yeah.
Or are you eating, shooting, and leaving? And it's all on a comma. But I don't know, there's a guy that does a thing called Word Rake that sends out grammatical stuff, and he has a whole treatise on why don't people just put that damn serial comma in.
Yeah.
Because with the comma, it's never ambiguous. Without the comma, the classic case was the I'm leaving it to my son, my daughter, and my other son, or something like that, and it was a comma after the first one. So do you
divide it 50, 25, 25, or 3?
Yeah, and you know what they did? They did 50, 25, 25 because of the missing comma. In any event.
Yeah, so
I don't have anything else.
Anything else, but
are there other questions on report number 4? Because again, you can always meet individually or...
There's always something
That was pretty... I thought that was pretty straightforward and non-controversial.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay, well, if that's the case, we can wrap up a bit early, and I will send out an email that just contains the dates regarding the final deadline for comments on Report 3 and 4, and then for the appended statement to the Enactment Plus. And
if you can kind of explain that, it would make it so much easier for those of us who are, gathering consensus and have a team approach to just spit that back out to the people without any sort of repackaging.
Yes. Okie dokie. Sounds good. So we can turn the recorder off now. And we're done.
Don?